Hello, you're listening to me, Sarah Jackman, and today I'm joined by Katie Dias, a senior associate in the employment team at law firm Goodman Derrick. Good morning, Katie.
Hi, Sarah.
Katie, the theme for today's podcast is employment law. What are the current initiatives and how do they affect property professionals? Katie, let's think first about the Good Work Plan, which was published in December 2018. This sets out the government's vision of the UK labour force, along with a number of other proposals for reform. Can you start by telling me about the initiative and the motivations behind it?
Yes, certainly, Sarah. I mean, the main motivator behind the Good Work Plan is actually the Taylor Review, which was published back in July 2017. And a lot of the recommendations that are set out by that Taylor Review have now been adopted in some way, shape or form by the Good Work Plan. And essentially, the aim is to make sure that legal changes are made to improve individuals' employment rights, as well as concentrate on the government's stated aim of improving the quality of work. Because now we have low rates of unemployment, the government's shifting its focus to the quality of work rather than the quantity. And the plan's broken down into three categories, essentially, which are called fair and decent work, clarity for employers and workers, and fairer enforcement. And they very much sum up the themes that are contained in the Good Work Plan.
And just tell me a little bit about the most relevant reforms for the property industry. What does the property professional need to keep in mind?
Well, actually, quite a lot of the changes that are set out in the Good Work Plan are relevant to property sector businesses. If I had to highlight just a few of them, I think the biggest one is probably going to be the clarifications that are going to be made to the employment status tests. So hopefully in the future, it's going to be easier to determine if an individual is engaged as an employee, a worker or self-employed. And given the amount of case law that we've had, obviously it's a much needed exercise and certainly relevant for the property industry. Many listeners will probably be familiar with the Pimlico Cummers case, which directly involved employment status of property sector personnel, obviously. And we wait to see how those tests are going to be modified. There's been a commitment to try and align those employment law tests with the tax law tests, which is going to be quite an interesting exercise because tax law only recognises the categories of employee and self-employed, whereas in employment law, we have this middle category of workers too. And kind of talking of workers, another quite big development in the Good Work Plan is that workers are going to have a new legal entitlement to receive a written statement setting out the basic terms, much in the same way as employees currently are entitled to receive written particulars of their employment. And again, the aim behind that is to improve the kind of transparency in the relationship. Having just mentioned the written particulars of employment, I probably should also mention that under the Good Work Plan, the current 2-month time frame that we have for issuing written particulars of employment, that's going to change, and instead it's going to become a day one right, which effectively means the contractual document needs to be put in place right at the start of the employment relationship. Personally, I think that's quite a sensible thing to do, even though we've got a 2-month window now. I certainly would advise my clients to do it as early as possible. And the reason I say that is because obviously having employment documentation in place hopefully means that both sides are very clear about the employment terms, meaning that you hopefully will avoid dispute later down the line. And certainly I've had to deal with situations where there's been arguments over things like commission terms or holiday rules or something like that that could easily have been avoided if those written terms had been in place earlier. And as well as the timescale changing, there's also going to be changes to the content that needs to be included in those written particulars. And there's going to be a little bit more additional information that needs to be added. Things like, for example, in relation to a probationary period. And I imagine that a majority of employers probably do provide fuller terms. But there will be some businesses, you know, it might be the smaller businesses or perhaps businesses like property management companies that have a lot of more junior or manual employees that might only give the legal minimum. So they do really need to make note of those changes. Going back to the Good Work Plan, another change that we're going to have is about continuity of service and how that's going to be calculated. Continuity of service is really important for a number of employment rights. The length of service can dictate the amount of notice that you're entitled to from an employer in order to terminate the employment. You need 2 years service in order to claim unfair dismissal in most cases. So it really does have a big impact. So if, Sarah, we imagine that perhaps you're an assistant employed on a casual basis at, say, a firm of surveyors, And let's imagine there's a 1 week break in your employment. You know, you're employed as a casual, there's no work, so they don't require your services. There's that gap of 1 week. Now, under the current employment law rules, that gap would break your continuity of service. The Good Work Plan promises to increase the gap from the current 1 week to 4 weeks, which means that there's going to be an increased number of casual employees that are going to benefit in the future from increased employment rights and protections. And another change that's going to help casual employees is this new right that's going to be introduced called the right to request a predictable and stable contract. Or in other words, the employer is going to be able to ask their employer to clarify things like their working hours or the days that they're expected to work. And it's going to be a totally new concept. So let's continue the example and imagine you're that same casual employee in the surveyor's firm. After 26 weeks of employment, you'll then have the right to request that your firm move you onto a more fixed working pattern. So that could be, for example, that you only work on Mondays to Thursdays, or that you work a minimum of 20 hours a week. And your employer will then have 3 months to consider that request and make a decision. And we wait to see exactly how the regime will work, but certainly it's going to be a new right for employees to have. And I suppose, finally, it's also worth me mentioning that there's going to be a change to the way that holiday pay is calculated. There's been a lot of cases recently on holiday pay. And essentially, the change under the Good Work Plan is that the reference period will increase from 12 weeks to 52 weeks. And that's going to be an important development for workers that have got variable hours. So take the example of a roofer. If we've got a roofer who only works, say, 20 hours a week in January, February and March, you know, it's shorter days, bad weather, they could work double that perhaps in June, July and August. They might work 40 hours a week. When the days are longer, the weather's dry, they can get more done. The pay that they would receive for holiday that's taken in April after working that short January, February and March would be half the holiday pay that they'd taken had they taken the holiday in September after working that long June, July and August. So extending the reference period from the 12 weeks that we currently have to 52 weeks hopefully means a more consistent and fairer holiday pay regime. Also, on the subject of holiday rights, I perhaps should also mention that the enforcement regime is going to change too. Currently, if an individual's holiday rights have been breached, that individual would normally bring a legal action in the employment tribunal if they can't sort out the dispute. Under the Good Work Plan, there's a promise that there will be the option of state intervention for vulnerable workers, and it's yet to see how vulnerable is going to be defined. We believe that it will work in a similar way to the enforcement mechanism that's currently used by Revenue and Customs in relation to national minimum wage. But again, we wait the exact details. And of course, there's loads of other changes too in the Good Work Plan, from having to provide key terms to agency workers to initiatives to improve job satisfaction and training opportunities. But I'm conscious perhaps I should stop there. I've already mentioned a few.
No, I mean, there's a huge amount potentially for the industry to be gearing up for. I mean, do we have a time frame for implementation for all of this?
Not for many of the reforms that are proposed. There are some changes that set out in the Good Work Plan that have already come into force. For example, we've got a new power to name and shame employers who don't pay compensation that's been awarded following a successful employment tribunal claim. That's already in. We've got others that we expect to come into force in April 2020, such as things like that new right for written statements for workers that I mentioned earlier. But for the majority, we do wait to see when they're going to be implemented. And I know that a lot of businesses and individuals and lawyers like me will be waiting to see when those promised clarifications to the employment status test are going to be delivered.
Another initiative, and something that's really quite topical at the moment, is the right to work in the UK. We have a government initiative, a new online tool that employers can use to check whether an employee has that right to work in the UK. Can you explain how that will work?
Yes, well, I suppose inevitably we're moving further and further into a more digital world. Mm-hmm. And the Home Office has launched a new platform where an employer is effectively able just to look up online whether an individual has the right to work in the UK. And it's an alternative way, really, of checking the individual's right to work to the paper checks that employers will be very familiar with, which usually consists of taking a copy of someone's passport or the relevant immigration documents.
And do you anticipate that that will have a positive time-saving effect?
Well, I don't think the paper checks are particularly time-consuming and onerous. I mean, essentially all they have to do is see the documents and take a copy. But what it does rely on is cooperation from the individual. And so if the individual forgets to bring their passport or the necessary immigration documents, then the employer used to be a bit stuck. And remember that an employer shouldn't be employing an individual until those checks have been done. So it could delay the start date if you've been asking that individual to bring it on their first day of employment. So now at least employers do have an alternative way to make the necessary checks. So hopefully it will make the process at least slicker. Although the individual does still have to provide the employer with various details, including what's known as a share code, in order for them to be able to perform these online checks. And thinking about perhaps larger employers who maybe have a lot of seasonal employees, you know, you might have a building firm that takes on a lot of new recruits to deal with some kind of summertime peak in demand. This new way of checking could potentially help them speed up the process because it can be done, you know, centrally and perhaps remotely. But what's important is that employers do these checks, whether that's paper or electronic, to make sure that they are complying with their legal requirements.
Thinking about the case law side of things, there were a number of decisions handed down last year in the employment law sphere. Can you talk us through the most relevant for the property professional?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, like the years before, 2018 was another busy year for the tribunals and the courts hearing employment law cases. And I think probably the hottest topic was employment status. People have seen that in the headlines in the press. There were a number of very high profile cases that we heard. We had Uber drivers looked at by the Court of Appeal, found to be workers rather than self-employed. A similar exercise done by the Employment Appeal Tribunal in relation to Addison Lee drivers and also their cycle couriers, again confirming them to be workers. The case I mentioned earlier, Pimlico Plumbers, that was looked at by the Supreme Court. And again, they found that those individuals were workers and not self-employed. But it's not just always the finding that they're workers. It might seem like it, but it's not. We've had the High Court finding that Deliveroo food delivery bikers, they were actually self-employed. They weren't workers. And these cases are very relevant for the property sector. You might have, for example, haulage drivers in a construction company that are labelled by the employer as self-employed. But actually, in the eyes of the law, they could be workers or possibly even employees. Obviously, it's not just plumbers. There are employment status issues. There are also other tradesperson, but also people like cleaners, security guards, those types of personnel used perhaps by property management companies. You might also have casual workers in other property sector businesses. For example, you might have somebody who comes out and helps on a regular basis in an estate agent, you know, perhaps every Saturday or something. And it might be that legally speaking, they aren't actually workers, they're employees. So the employment status cases are definitely relevant for the property profession. And the legal tests, they're complicated. And somebody's true status really depends on a number of factors. And they're judged on their own particular circumstances. So it can be very difficult to determine. And essentially, the courts and the tribunals have to look at lots of different things. They look at things like the level of control that's exerted over the individual, whether the individual has to perform the work personally, the employer's expectations are, what the individual's expectations are, and a whole raft of other things. But as I say, the Good Work Plan is going to look at these employment status tests. So we might see reform and perhaps clarity for future years. But certainly it's been taking up a lot of tribunal and court time. Another case from 2018 that I was going to mention involved data protection issues. And with the GDPR that came into force last year in May, I thought that probably data protection has been a big talking point for many property professionals. The case involved a disgruntled senior employee who worked in an IT department. And effectively, he went in and took a list of around 100,000 employees' details. And he took it and he published it online, effectively to cause reputational damage for his employer. And the Court of Appeal found that the employer had put into place, you know, adequate and appropriate data protection controls, but nevertheless, they were vicariously liable for that individual's actions. And it was quite an alarming decision for employers because effectively it was saying, even if as an employee you do everything you're meant to do, you're still responsible for the malicious acts of your rogue employees. Before everyone panics who listens to this, the circumstances were quite unique. The employee in this case, his remit was to deal with confidential data. Specifically, it was part of his job to handle the confidential payroll information that he took. And I think it's also worth noting that this individual was actually sentenced to 8 years imprisonment. So that in itself is likely to be deterrent for most people who might even have a think about doing this type of action. But also under the new GDPR regime that we have, there would probably be tighter data controls in place anyway now. But if listeners are concerned, then the practical way forward is to investigate cyber insurance to protect against this risk. The last case I was going to mention from 2018 is quite a memorable case, mainly because of the offensive language that was used, and perhaps its surprising result. And it's the case that's often referred to as the Fat Ginger Pikey case. And it essentially addressed whether that type of comment was harassment or just mere workplace banter. The individual had associations with the travelling community, and he suffered from type 1 diabetes, which can cause weight gain. But the Employment Appeal Tribunal found that despite that, comment wasn't unwanted, neither did it violate his dignity or create an offensive environment for him. And these are all parts of the test for race and disability harassment. But they held that in these particular circumstances, the comment was actually just part of the office banter, and that the claimant was a very active participant in that banter culture. And as I say, some people might find the decision quite surprising. And certainly, despite the finding, I'm not advocating that these are acceptable comments to be making in the workplace. The judgment made it very clear that in different circumstances, that same comment could well have been considered harassment. So I think the takeaway point for employers is that they should be remembering to train their employees and workers on what is and isn't acceptable language in the workplace. And that's going to be truer for some employers than others, where you've got, for example, work environments like a building site. Perhaps there's more scope for camaraderie, or maybe a high pressured sales environment like an estate agent, where perhaps banter is much more prevalent. Training is going to be important because it's quite easy for people to overstep the mark.
And how are things shaping up in 2019? What can we expect from the courts?
Well, I expect that we probably haven't seen the end of employment status case law being developed, but we've talked about that quite a lot. So on other topics, I think there's two quite interesting discrimination cases coming up in the Court of Appeal. The first case is due to be heard next week, I think, actually. And it's a case about disability discrimination based on a perceived disability. So the individual involved is not actually disabled themselves, but the employer believed that she was disabled. And the question is whether the disability protection should extend to her. The tribunal said that the disability discrimination protection shouldn't apply to her, but the Employment Appeal Tribunal said that they should. So it's now going to go up to the Court of Appeal to see what they make of it and how they rule. And obviously that is a relevant development. If we've got, for example, a property management company recruiting a security guard and perhaps not taking somebody on because they mistakenly thought that he'd got maybe significant hearing difficulties, then there could be a disability discrimination claim there, even though that security guard might not actually be disabled himself. The other discrimination case that I was thinking of was one in which a father is challenging the fact that his employer pays enhanced maternity pay for mothers taking maternity leave, but only the statutory minimum pay for fathers taking shared parental leave. And again, it's a Court of Appeal case. And the tribunal said, well, it was sex discrimination to only give enhanced family pay to mothers. But the Employment Appeal Tribunal disagreed, and it said, well, if you have a female in a same-sex relationship and they were to take shared parental leave, then that woman would only receive the statutory parental leave pay just like fathers were, and therefore it wasn't discriminatory. So we wait to see what the Court of Appeal says. Now, obviously, depending on the outcome of that case, there could be a need for employers to revise their family policies, in particular the level of pay that they offer. And it might well be that property businesses, and particularly those perhaps that are more male dominated, perhaps thinking maybe construction, engineering, that sector. Some employers do introduce things like enhanced maternity pay policies in an effort to either attract or retain female talent. So it might be an area that does need to be looked at by some property professionals. On a totally different subject, we await judgment from the Supreme Court on a case that concerns whether a post-termination non-compete restriction is valid. And it turns on the construction of a particular clause in an individual's contract of employment. And in a nutshell, that non-compete clause was drafted in such a way that it prevented the individual from having any involvement at all with a competitor, even if that was very minor involvement, such as holding a few shares in a very large competitor company. So arguably, it was far too wide and therefore shouldn't be enforced. Now, what's interesting is that the individual had no intention of just being a minor shareholder. She actually wanted to go and work for this direct competitor. But she was using that argument in order to try and defeat the clause. And I think that this case serves as a good reminder that restrictive covenants need to be very carefully thought out, and they need to be drafted properly in order to be enforceable. So those people in the property sector who are employers trying to protect their business maybe they've got talented architects that they're worried about leaving, or well-connected senior influential managers. They'll want to keep an eye out on this legal development, and they'll really want to be checking that the contractual protection that they've got in their employment documentation is going to be able to stand up to scrutiny.
We've touched then on what's coming up at the higher court level. Do you see any particular trends in the employment tribunals this year? For example, has the Me Too movement led to an increase in associated cases?
Well, in terms of general trends, the top four claims that we've seen for the last few years have consistently been unfair dismissal, equal pay, working time and unlawful deductions from wages. In answer to your question about the Me Too movement, well, unfortunately, we haven't had the most recent annual statistics out yet, and the Me Too movement didn't really gather pace until the latter half of 2017. So we can't accurately tell whether there's been a bit of a surge in kind of those types of cases. But from a personal perspective, I haven't really seen that massive increase in sexual harassment claims as part of my caseload. It is worth remembering, however, that the time limit for bringing a sex discrimination claim is relatively short. It's 3 months from the date of the last discriminatory act. So employees that are coming forward and talking about historic acts might actually find that they're out of time to bring an employment tribunal claim. What I have found as a result of the Me Too movement is that there has been a much more increase in the awareness about sexual harassment issues. And certainly some employers have been much more inclined to update things like harassment at work policies and to give training to their workforce about acceptable behaviours, and in particular kind of emphasising respect at work.
Finally, and almost inevitably, no discussion of 2019 could be complete without a mention of Brexit. Now, obviously, the UK employment landscape is heavily tied to that of the European laws and regulation. What thoughts do you have just in terms of how that might be affected in 2019?
Well, it is a million-dollar question, isn't it? We wait to see exactly what's going to happen. There's so much uncertainty at the moment about what's going to happen in the future. But certainly, at least for the short term, there has been a commitment that workers' rights won't be rolled back. And the good work plan that I mentioned at the outset really does continue to build on and strengthen worker rights and employment rights. Whether we're going to see changes in the future, well, I think we're all just going to have to wait and see. But the immediate concern for employers, I don't think, is going to be employment rights as such. I think it's going to be immigration issues.
OK. And finally, Katie, what three things or three top tips do you have for our listeners, just really from the employment law perspective, to bear in mind for 2019?
Well, it's quite hard to just think of three, I'll be honest. But I think the first thing is that because of the amount of reform that we are expecting and that we know is going to be coming up in the pipeline, I think employers need to ensure that they are ready and prepared for the changes. And in particular, I'm thinking about the Good Work Plan that I mentioned earlier. Most of those changes aren't going to be effective until 2020 and beyond, but it doesn't stop people having a think now about how they will impact. For example, is your business going to be likely to receive requests for a predictable and stable contract? If so, do you want to preempt that? Do you want to get those employees moved on to different contracts now? Holiday pay, as I mentioned, is going to be changed in the way that it is calculated. Will that mean an extra cost for the business? Are you able to absorb that? So it's really thinking practically about how those upcoming changes will impact on your particular business. Secondly, I would say that I think businesses should have a think about how their workforce is classified. Do they have employees? Do they have workers? Do they have self-employed? Do they have a combination or all of them? And for some, that will be plainly obvious. But for other property professionals, that really won't be. And it might even be that they need to go and get some professional help as to what categories of worker or employee or self-employed that they might have. The reason we get so worked up about employment status is because it's really important to determine someone's rights. An employee has far greater rights than a worker. For example, an employee has the right not to be unfairly dismissed or the right to receive statutory redundancy pay in certain circumstances. But workers have far greater rights than self-employed. For example, the one that is often the reason for litigation is the right to paid holiday, which a worker has, but a self-employed person doesn't. with the high profile cases that we've seen recently, and with individuals becoming far more savvy about their employment rights and perhaps being therefore more likely to challenge their employer, we are seeing people needing to focus and analyse their workforce a bit. My third and final tip, I think, would be about educating your workforce, so how to behave at work. And I say that in part because of the Me Too movement that's raised greater awareness about sex discrimination, but also remembering the case I mentioned earlier where a comment was analysed to see if it was just mere banter or whether that was actually harassment. And it can be a very fine line, so it's important that your workforce stays on the right side of that. Training of staff is incredibly important, and it can stop issues from developing. You know, it can save management time and stress in dealing with things like grievances, and it can even help you successfully defend an employment tribunal claim. And I know that many listeners will probably be thinking, you know, well, I've already done training in the past, but don't underestimate the value of refreshing people's memory by having regular training and also revising things like handbook policies to keep them relevant and to keep them fresh. So I think, in summary, I would say my three tips would be, firstly, prepare for the upcoming changes. We're going to see a lot on the horizon. Secondly, review your current situations, in particular thinking about employment status issues. And thirdly, educate your workforce, really try and head off potential trouble before it starts.
Well, on that note, Katie Dias, thank you very much indeed. There's a huge amount clearly going on in the employment law sphere this year, and it's been invaluable to have that distilled for us today and to really look at the application for the property professional. Thank you.